1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verses 12 through 22, Nathan just read for us, and we have used that, entitled our lesson, Final Exhortations as Goals for 2020. These are the final words that Paul wrote, at least in this letter. He writes another letter to them, but in this letter, these are the final words that he writes to them. And as always is the case in most of Paul's epistles, that there are all of these rapid-fire exhortations that Paul gives, as if these are the last things that he wants them to be thinking about, the last things that he wants to have in their hearing. And so I thought, well, that's a great series of exhortations as goals for us in the upcoming year. And so this morning we looked at an outline of this section, and we see that in verses 12 and 13, he is giving exhortations regarding the elders and what their responsibility and attitude should be toward the elders. In verses 14 and 15, we find that there are exhortations regarding others, members of the Lord's body. And then we're going to see in just a moment that that extends even beyond members of the Lord's body into those that are outside the Lord's body. And then we find in verses 16 through 22 that these exhortations are exhortations regarding ourselves. What is my attitude toward the elders? What is my attitude toward others and toward those outside the Lord's church? And then what are some admonitions that I need to have, that I need to be doing personally? And we looked at this morning the fact that these men that are leaders, that the Apostle Paul says, these men have charge over you. These men diligently labor in your midst. And these men give you instruction. Now you'll notice from Nathan's reading that there's some different translations of that. But if you notice that in the give you instruction, his version actually said admonishing. And we pointed that out this morning, that that's the definition of that word. And so since these men have charge over you, and since these men diligently labor to the point of being weary, that's the kind of labor that's talked about there, and since they give you instruction, then you must appreciate them, you must esteem them highly, and you must live in peace with them. This evening what we want to look at is some exhortations that Paul gives in regards to others. And these, as we've already stated, these are divided into two categories, I would suggest. I have some exhortations regarding my treatment of you and how I should be toward you. Paul says that I'm to admonish the unruly, I'm to encourage the faint-hearted, and I'm to help the weak. All of those found in verse 14. But then I have some admonitions toward you again, but admonitions that are also attitudes that I need to have toward you, but also have toward all men. I need to be patient with everyone. Verse 14. And then I don't need to repay evil with evil, but I should always seek after that which is good. So let's look at these and let's see if we can explore them a little bit deeper. What about this matter of admonishing the unruly? We've already defined that word this morning when we talked about the matter of giving instruction. And so we'll look at this definition very quickly. That word admonish just simply means to put in mind. And that is, by implication, it is to caution and it is to reprove gently. To admonish someone means that there is a danger. There is some sort of an issue out there that they are going to be faced with, maybe shortly they're going to be faced with, or maybe they've already are faced with that and they're making poor choices in the way in which they're handling that. Admonishing is a little more urgent than just encouraging. Admonishing is a little more urgent than just exhorting. Admonishing is that there is a foreseeable danger, or the danger is here and it's not being handled very well. And so this is wherein, individuals, I need to put you in mind of the fact and caution you and maybe even reprove gently. Now, there is another word, and it's just simply the word reprove or the word rebuke, and that's a little more intense than admonish. There's kind of levels of intensity in reference to encouraging someone to try to get them to do what they need to be doing. But in this one, it says it is to caution and it is to reprove. The question, though, is who is it that Paul says needs this admonishing? There is a certain group that Paul identifies as needing this admonishing. In the case of this text, it is not a danger that's out there somewhere that may be getting faced here in the near future. It is something that someone is doing right now. That they are not living as they ought to be living. The unruly is what is the New American Standard says. And that word unruly, it is the same word you may think, well, I've heard that later in the second letter. And you'd be right. Withdraw from those who walk disorderly. That's that same word, unruly. It's that word which means out of ranks. It was a military term in which everyone had ranks. They had a line. Now, I was never in the military, but I was in marching band. And I can remember in marching band, there were two things that we would to look at that would tell us if we were out of ranks. And one of the things was, watch your diagonal. Over and over again, watch your diagonal. It wasn't so much looking down the line as it was, look at your diagonal. Look at your diagonal. If you can't see it, then you're too far forward or you're too far back. And the second thing was, if your head is going up when everybody else's head is going down, you're out of step. You're walking at a different pace. You're out of step with everybody else. You're out of ranks. You're different than everybody else. You're out of position where you need to be. And there are sometimes that people in their lives are disorderly. It's out of the prescribed order in which they need to be living. Look at the rest of this definition. Irregular or inordinate or deviating from the prescribed rule, prescribed order or rule. Now, I can't not point out the fact that by virtue of the fact that someone can walk unruly, it then obviously states there is a rule. If I'm my own rule, then I really can't walk ever disorderly. But if there is a prescribed rule that has application to all, if there is an objective standard that all are supposed to live by, and that I can look at someone else and I can determine if they're living by that or not, then that tells me the standard is objective. But if your truth is your truth and my truth is my truth, and I really don't know, I may look at you and think, well, you're not walking according to the truth, but you're not walking according to my truth, that's what people will say today. Who are you to tell me that I'm wrong? I have my own walk. I have my own way. I have my own path to God. And you have your path to God. You don't have the right to say, that's not right. You don't have the right to say, I'm disorderly. I'm out of ranks. I'm unruly. But if there is an objective standard, then that necessitates the fact that my ability to look at you and to be able to say, you're out of order, you're unruly, and I'm going to warn you and caution you and admonish you, that necessitates the standard is objective. That we all can look at it, we all can look at it, look at one another, and determine, are we walking according to the standard? The standard is beyond me. It's above me. It's not just my own personal standard. So admonish those who are walking out of ranks. Caution them. Reprove them. You're not living as you should. You're living outside that prescribed order. Now, every one of these would be a sermon in and of itself, but we're not going to take that much time. So let me suggest something to you. We need to understand that regardless of who the unruly may be, we are under obligation to admonish. And if I fail to admonish, now I'm the unruly. Because now I'm not following the standard. The prescribed order that God has is when someone walks unruly, others who see that need to warn them, need to caution them, need to admonish them. And if they don't do that, now this person's unruly. And now the person that sees this individual is unruly. Now he's unruly because he's not following the prescribed order. And brethren, it doesn't matter who it is. It doesn't matter if it's my wife, my children, my parents, my good friend, my uncle, my aunt. It doesn't matter who it is. If that individual is walking unruly, then the relationship that they have toward the prescribed order, God's prescribed order, that relationship takes precedence over every other relationship, over every other connection that I have. That's more important than blood, than money, than friendship. That's more important. And it has to take precedence. And so it doesn't matter who the unruly person is, because if I recognize that and I see that they're not walking as they should and I don't do anything about it, now I'm unruly. If the unruly fail to heed the admonishing, then they must be withdrawn from. That's what 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 6 says. Withdraw from those who walk disorderly. But I want you to notice that in verse 15, the admonishing still continues. We're admonishing them to change. We're admonishing them to come back and to repent and to align their lives according to the prescribed order. And sometimes they refuse to do that. And so then because they remain unruly and disorderly, we have to withdraw from them. But the admonishing continues. That doesn't change. It still continues. We're still warning. We're still cautioning them to return. There's a second thing that Paul says that we need to do toward one another, and that is encourage the faint-hearted. That word encourage means to speak kindly, soothingly, to comfort or to pacify or to console. Isn't it interesting in the list of things that Paul says of obligations that I have toward you and that we have toward one another, isn't it interesting that Paul selected admonish the unruly as the first one? We might ease into it, wouldn't we? We might have put this one first. We might have put something that everybody agrees with, everybody sees the need of, and kind of worked into it. Paul recognized, I don't know if by inspiration, that the more difficult admonition and the more difficult exhortation to live by is the one that says you admonish those who are unruly. In fact, you remember in 1 Corinthians 5, Paul said that I put you to, or 2 Corinthians 2, that I put you to the test to see whether or not you would do what I told you to do in 1 Corinthians chapter 5. If we are willing to admonish the unruly, I would suggest to you, we'll have no problem encouraging the faint-hearted and helping the weak. But if we help the weak and encourage the faint-hearted, sometimes we never get to the admonishing of the unruly. Paul starts there. He says, if you can get this one, you'll get these other two. Encourage the faint-hearted. Speak kindly, soothingly, to comfort, to pacify. What does it mean to be faint-hearted? Now, different versions render it differently, but here are some definitions of that. The idea of faint-hearted is to be fretful or to be worried or just to be despondent. Some have said low of heart has been one of the definitions that I saw. I didn't put it on the slide. But it is low of heart. They're despondent. They're worried. They're fretful about things. All that comes into play. And so the question then is, well, what causes faint-heartedness? What causes someone to be at a disposition where they're worried or they're despondent or they're faint? And there are any number of things. Again, every one of these is a lesson in itself. But let me suggest to you, sometimes circumstances in life causes us to get faint-hearted. Maybe our health isn't what we wish our health would be. And we get discouraged. We get despondent. Sometimes we're worried about our employment. Our employment is in question. There are any number of things that happen in life that is just part of living. It's nothing that we have done. It's nothing that, it's no choice that we have made. It's not a consequence of a decision that we have made. It's just living life under the sun. Sometimes it's just not fair. I can remember a good friend of ours in Oklahoma, Rob Mackey, and his girls would say, well, that's not fair, when he would say something about not allowing them to do something. And I can always remember his comment. I was there at a couple of times when he told them this. He said, well, you need to get used to the fact that life's not fair. And I thought, yeah, that's right. Sometimes life just isn't fair. And sometimes we allow that to kind of overwhelm us to the point of we get despondent about that. We get worried about that. And so that causes faintheartedness. Now, as a child of God, we ought to recognize that these things happen. I'm not talking about a choice that you've made that's a consequence of a choice that you made or a decision that you made. I'm just talking about things that just happen, that just happen. Sometimes that causes us to get frustrated. Sometimes it's problems at home, or problems at work, or problems in the local church. Talking to bus drivers and listening to some of their problems and discussions, it's just interesting that some of the people that are very worldly, you know, make comments like, you know, this world would be a great place if it wasn't for people. I'm like, well, that's probably some truth to that. But so long as there are humans, there are going to be problems. And so long as there are humans who have drastically different worldviews about life, they're going to clash, and there are going to be issues, and there are going to be problems. And so sometimes we get so concerned about that, and when we fret so much about that, it causes us to be faint-hearted and despondent. Sometimes it's just disappointment. Sometimes it's disappointment in ourselves. I just can't believe I did that. And we get despondent. We get fretful. We get worried. We get faint-hearted. Sometimes it's just disappointment in others. I really thought better. I really thought they wouldn't do that. I can't believe that. And it causes faint-heartedness. Paul tells us then that what needs to be done is that we need to encourage. But what I want us to see in this is that anyone at any time can become faint-hearted. I think sometimes we look at that, well, if you're faint-hearted, you're not strong in faith. Well, even the strong in faith found themselves in situations where they fainted for a second. They were despondent for a moment. When Paul was in Corinth in Acts chapter 18, it seems that he was a little despondent, a little discouraged, and he was fearful, so much so that the Lord came to him in a vision and said, stay here and preach. I've got people here. And he stayed 18 months. It would seem that Paul was getting a little discouraged because he could see the handwriting on the wall. As we saw this morning in our Bible class, he said, I don't know what's going to happen to me in Jerusalem when I get there, but I know that the Holy Spirit has said that wherever I go, that chains await me, imprisonment, difficulty, turmoil. I know that wherever I go, that's what awaits me. And maybe it was one of those times in which he'd had it, and he came to Corinth, and here it comes again. It wasn't that it was any different. It wasn't that it was any worse. It's just that sometimes those things just kind of pile up on you, like, here we go again. And you get despondent. My point is that we need to not look at someone who is despondent and who is fretful and who is worried and say, well, you ought to have stronger faith, and rebuke them. That's not what the Bible says. Especially if it is something that has happened that is beyond their control. What does the Bible say? These are not to be condemned. They're to be comforted. They're to be consoled. They're to be encouraged. Because the problem is they are discouraged. Faint-heartedness is just another expression for discouraged. They've lost courage. They've lost heart. And so what they need is for someone to give them heart, give them encouragement, comfort and console, and say, let's get through this. Let's get through this together. There's a third thing that we're told that we're to have toward one another, and that is to help. Help the weak. That word help means to adhere to. In fact, I like what Thayer says. It is to hold to him firmly. The word weak there is without strength. Weak, infirm, feeble. I think what we're talking about here is I don't think we're talking about someone that is physically weak, physically feeble, and you need to make sure and hang on to them. Paul is talking about spiritual matters. And so he's talking about times in which people get spiritually weak. And that when there's that spiritual weakness, and when they're without strength and they're weak, they're feeble, they're infirm in their spirit, then they need to be helped. Think about the dangers of spiritual weakness. When people are weak spiritually, they are easy pickings for the devil. We've all watched these nature shows, and we've all seen a herd of caribou or a herd of gazelles, and you see a lion, or you see some sort of a tiger that's stalking. And every time you know, they're looking and watching for which one? Not the strongest. They're watching for one that's young. They're watching for one that's sickly. They're watching for one that's injured. They're looking for one that's weak. And that's the one they're going to pounce on. Isn't it ironic that Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8 that the devil is a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. He's watching the herd. He's watching the Christians as they go by. He's looking to see which one of them is weak or is sickly. Which one of them is not going to have the strength to overcome him. And so that's where he pounces. For every one of these shows that we've seen, how many times does the gazelle escape? How many times does the animal that is sought after, that is weak or sickly or injured, get away? What makes you think that you'll get away if you're spiritually weak? In Matthew chapter 26 and verse 41, our Lord gives his disciples an admonition. He said that you need to be watchful for temptation. Be aware of the fact that temptation is out there. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. In other words, when it comes to temptation, your spirit may be, I'm not going to be tempted, but sometimes because the flesh is weak, it sucks the spirit in. Well, let me ask you, if the spirit is weak and the flesh is weak, what chance do you have of overcoming temptation? You see why we're back to 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. You're easy pickings for the devil. And then finally, in James chapter 1 and verses 13 through 15, here's the problem with spiritual weakness. The ultimate consequence of that is death. Again, how do the videos and how does it play out for the deer or whatever the animal that the lion is stalking, how does it normally play out for that animal? They don't survive the attack. Let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is accomplished, it brings forth death. So do you see what's at stake? They're not going to overcome temptation. They're going to be easy pickings for our adversary. They're going to lose their spiritual life because they are spiritually weak. Do you see what's at stake? And so is it surprising then that we are told to help, that we are told to hold him firmly. We need to protect those who are weak. That person that is spiritually weak, that is ripe pickings for the devil, that is going to fall into temptation, and that is going to lose their spiritual soul. Do you see why Paul says what needs to happen to those who are that weak? They need help. It's not just the kind of help that we might think. They need to be grabbed onto, held onto, adhered to. They need to be hung onto because they're going to die if we don't do something. So let me ask you, are you willing to change and abandon your plans when someone reaches out to you needing help? Are you willing to give up your time when someone says, I'm struggling here, I'm feeling low, I'm thinking about this or that, and you know that's not going to be good if you do that? Do you give up your time? Do you go? Are you willing to go at a moment's notice to help? Do you see what's at stake? When someone's that spiritually weak, they are ripe for the devil, and I can guarantee you the devil already has them in his sights. Somebody needs to help that one. Someone needs to adhere to them. Someone needs to hold on to that one so that the devil doesn't get them. Are you willing to help the weak? And then he says that we need to be patient with everyone. That word patient means long suffering. Did you hear that second part of that word? The second part of long suffering is suffering. Patience isn't easy, is it? The idea that, well, I want patience, but I don't want any trials to happen to me. I don't want any difficulties. I don't want any problems. I don't want any suffering. Well, then you'll never get patience because patience is suffering. That's the nature of patience. Now, patience is the ability that in the midst of suffering, I learn how to work through that, deal with that. It is long suffering. In this particular word, it means to suffer long, to be long suffering, as opposed to being hasty in anger or punishment. The fact that we are told to be patient with tells me where the suffering's coming from. I need to be patient with everyone. There are times that I receive suffering from my own brethren. There are times that I receive suffering from those of the world. And the idea here that Paul is saying is that you need to be able to weather that storm, and that anger and wrath needs to be a long ways away. You cannot be hasty in anger and hasty in punishment. That's not patient. That's not long-suffering. You need to be patient. Now, we all know the statement. Sometimes people will really do what? Try your patience. They will really try to see just how long is your long. Just how far down the road will you let that I'm doing to you cause you to get mad and angry and lash out. We need to be patient, long-suffering with our brethren. Because sometimes brethren will sin against you. It just happens. Sometimes brethren will cause you suffering by virtue of the sin that they have committed. And it may be very personal. And it may be very hurtful. In Matthew chapter 18, verses 15 through 17, Jesus acknowledged that fact. That if your brother sins against you. How much more personal does that mean? It's not if your brother sins, if your brother sins against you. Sometimes brethren have frustrating scruples that we have to work around, as they did in Romans chapter 14 and verses 1 through 4. Sometimes brethren make quick judgments. They make a judgment, they tell others about it, and so pretty soon we've got a forest fire that we've got to put out, all because what? They made a quick, snappy, hasty judgment, and the whole judgment is completely wrong. But the damage has been done. Sometimes we have to suffer long with brethren who sin against us, who have frustrating scruples, and who make quick judgments. Sometimes we have to suffer long with non-Christians. We can't withdraw from non-Christians. Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 9 and 10, "When I wrote to you to tell you not to keep company with sexually immoral people, I did not mean those of the world, because then you'd have to go out of the world." So Paul says, I'm not saying that you withdraw yourself from those kind of people. So what do we do? Well, you just have to suffer long with them. We have to understand, brethren, that our faith and our worldview will oftentimes be misunderstood. Back when our children were in choir and when we come around the Christmas time, then they would sing these religious Christmas songs, and a lot of our kids would then just quietly step off the stage because they didn't want to sing a religious song with musical accompaniment. Did you know that we heard later that there was one person that said they must not believe in God? That must be why they step off the stage, because they don't believe in God and they don't want to sing a religious song. That wasn't what we were doing at all. But it was just a demonstration, at least to Leslie and I, it was a demonstration of the fact that, you know, sometimes what we're doing because of our faith, sometimes the choices and the decisions that we're making because of our faith actually is misconstrued and misunderstood. Sometimes that's what happens. Our worldviews are different. And sometimes they come crashing together. I have on the slide 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 through 24, where in reference to Jesus, the Jews stumbled over Jesus. In reference to Jesus, the Greeks thought it was foolishness. What is this? We have a clash of worldviews in that context. Christians see Jesus as their Savior. Jews saw Jesus as an impostor, blasphemer, and they stumbled over Him. The Greeks saw a man that would come back from the dead, resurrected, ridiculous. A clash of worldviews. And yet all those worldviews were striving to live together in the city of Corinth. And so sometimes we just have to understand our worldviews and our faith is just going to be different than other people. And we're going to have to suffer long. Sometimes these clashing worldviews result in a backlash or a pushback. We ought not to be surprised when that happens. Paul said in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12, "Those who desire to live godly shall suffer persecution." Final two things that Paul says is not evil for evil, but good despite evil. I have an obligation to treat outsiders a certain way. You know, this is actually in 1 Thessalonians, this is actually the third time that Paul has talked about how that these brethren should treat those that are outside the Lord's church. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 12, he suggests that they need to treat them in a certain way to increase toward love to all people, not just to the brethren. In chapter 4 in verse 12, "So that you may behave properly toward outsiders," he says. And here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verses 14 and 15, "We urge you, brethren, that see that no one repays evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all people." Evil has been received. And so the question is, how should I respond? Notice that in that context, Paul doesn't deny the fact that someone did something that was evil toward me. I've received evil. "See that no one repays another with evil." For what? What would be the reason that I would give evil? Because I've received evil. But he said, Always seek after that which is good. It's interesting that this is a principle that comes up over and over again in the New Testament. The fact that Christians will often receive what they did not deserve. The fact that Christians will often receive evil. Paul talked about that in Romans chapter 12, verse 17. And verses 19 through 21, he says, don't seek your own vengeance. He coals of fire upon their head, and that they might return. And that's just a quote from Proverbs chapter 25, verses 21 and 22. Peter talks about it in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 18. He talks about if you suffer because you've done something wrong and you take it patiently, big deal. But if you suffer for doing right and take it patiently, then that is to be honored. God sees that because now you're following the example of Jesus that he goes into in verse 21. Now you're following the example of Jesus who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. He received reviling, and so what did he do? Well, he didn't give it back. He received evil, and so what did he do? He didn't return it. In fact, the text says, I must actively seek after what is good. That word, seek after, it's actually one word in the Greek, and it means to pursue, to do something with intense effort and with definite purpose or with goal. To do with effort, to strive toward. Sometimes we get the, I'll weather the evil, but we don't seek after the good. And in this, Paul says, you need to not repay evil with evil. Well, I want to give them something. Well, you give them good. That's what you give them. That's what you repay it with. Which is good for one another and for all. Paul said the same thing in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10. Do good unto all, especially the household of faith. I have an obligation to you. If I receive evil from you, I am not to give evil back to you. Neither am I to do it if it comes from those who are people of the world. And so, we have exhortations regarding the elders. Appreciate, esteem, live in peace. We have exhortations regarding others, specifically our brethren. Admonish them, encourage them, help them. The unruly, the faint-hearted, and the weak. The unruly admonish, the faint-hearted encourage, and the help, or the weak need help. And then finally, exhortations regarding our brethren and all others. Be patient with your brethren and all men. Don't repay evil for evil from your own brethren and from others. Always seek after that which is good for your brethren, and yes, even for those who are not your brethren and who have nothing good to say about you and actually fighting against you. Those are some challenges, aren't they, for this next year? But things that Paul challenged the church in Thessalonica to do, we can do those things as well. If you're here this evening, your life is not what it needs to be, and we can help you make it right, let us know. Come forward. Well, together we stand and while we sing.